What would cause you to leave South Dakota? And why do you stay? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Monday. It's May 24th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we explore a new project called Coming Home. It's a public media collaboration that seeks to elevate the stories and storytelling of rural America. We talk first about new data that helps us understand how we see ourselves. Then it was a big idea that turned out to be a little too big. We explore efforts to turn South Dakota into an international shipping port on Images of the Past. We look at a new zine that celebrates local musicians and bands. That's coming later in the hour. Plus, can your arm become magnetized after the vaccine? No. No, it can't. Shankar Kura is with us. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. And I'm Lori Walsh. It's been a while since so many business owners had to deeply reevaluate their business models while simultaneously juggling staffing demands, supply chain disruption, personal illness, and in-store physical distancing requirements. All right, what happens next? Michelle Kane is the director of South Dakota CEO. That's a business center. It's partially grant-funded by the U.S. Small Business Administration. They're on the campus of Black Hill State University in Spearfish, and you can look for a new center soon in the city of Sioux Falls. Michelle Kane is joining us today to talk about the next normal in business as customers return and rediscover their favorite shops and stores and services. Michelle, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Lori. It's great to be back.
So you have provided training for businesses about bringing customers back into those brick and mortar spaces or reevaluating business plans for online spaces. What is one of the first things that business owners really need to think about when it comes to customer expectations right now?
You know, and it has been a year of chaos, right? And we are starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel, but that doesn't mean that businesses can or should go back to exactly what they did before, especially if it wasn't working, right? It's really made business owners take a step back. So here's the first thing. Even if you think your customers know if and when you're open, don't assume they know. You know, a lot of businesses have made changes to their open hours at various stages over the last 14 months. So it's a good time to review everywhere online. That could be their website, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Yelp or TripAdvisor if they use those review platforms. So it's just an opportunity to do that refresh and make sure that they're current. And also, even if they never closed or changed their hours, it's a great time to reinforce those hours since some people are just emerging to start shopping in person again.
Yeah, which means we should talk about gratitude and maybe even a little forgiveness. And I'm going to say this, Michelle. I went into a shop the other day and I saw the employee that I knew from, you know, this place of business. And I thought, oh, it's so great to see you. And immediately I realized I didn't support you at all during this. Like, there were certain businesses that I was really intent on making sure I showed up for. And this was one that I just forgot. So gratitude for supporting business and forgiving those customers who maybe didn't show up when you wanted them to.
I love it. And it's so common. You know, this is really a time to emphasize the power of human connection. Since so many shoppers may have resorted to online ordering over this last year, you are not alone. We are not alone. And we know, you know, we've kind of gotten into a habit. So getting back, we want businesses to start creating that habit to want to walk into the door. And when those customers do walk into your business, this is an opportunity to really go out of your way to make them feel welcome. And maybe it's a time to reflect on some customer service training or some just, you know, rethinking the business strategy, even the flow of your store, because it's time to deliver that human connection that shoppers crave. And yes, understanding that we were all in different places over the last year, giving some gratitude and giving some forgiveness goes both ways. I love that. Yeah.
And you don't know what kind of grief or illness people have been through. You don't know what the shop owners have been through from an economic standpoint. Are there ways to sort of make those connections that are, you know, that reveal just enough about, you know, how difficult it has been without getting too personal or revealing too much about your business? Where does that line fall when you are in small business and know so many of your community customers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, sometimes it's just nice to set some expectations. Set some expectations of what your customers or shoppers can expect when they come into your business, because it is such a personal, it was a personal journey that we all went through. And regardless of how it was approached, you know, the marketplace has changed. So it's important just to accept that, acknowledge that. And you know what? There were some things that you might have done during the pandemic that you changed and perhaps that you want to keep on doing. So those are the things to consider. Perhaps it was curbside delivery or maybe a special power hour shopping for, you know, a small group of friends. We've come to expect a lot of different things from those that we are shopping with, right? It's super convenient, but it's also a little bit of grace too, because of some of the challenges that we have gone through just over the last year.
Yeah, it seems subscription services is an area that really got a lot of traction during the pandemic, as people just wanted a monthly pick-me-up from, you know, a clothing store or a bookstore or a toy store. Are you seeing businesses who are interested in trying to figure out how to expand into that kind of market based on their current business model?
You know, it's something that I think each business should look at, because obviously all of these components don't apply across the board. However, we can learn and look at different types of industries and what they're doing. The subscription model is brilliant, and there could be a place, and maybe it's not exactly that. It's not a HelloFresh, for example, exactly that. But what can you take? You know, and a lot of that is convenience. So it's like, how can you make your products and services more convenient to your particular target audience in your particular community? Convenience. Wow, we want extreme convenience, right? We want to drive up and pick up something, or we want to pick up the phone and have something delivered, or we just want to make it really easy. So convenience and ease, I think, is something that all of our businesses can consider.
All right. Not a bad time to reach out and get some training and rethink and reinvent who you are as a person in business, whether you own your business or you're just working for someone else. Michelle Kane is director of South Dakota CEO, and they have that training. We'll put a link up on our website at sdpb.org. They're in Spearfish, but you can also look for a new center soon in Sioux Falls. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Up next, we are going to talk with Dr. Shankar Kura. Those COVID vaccine myths continue. So if you stick a magnet to your arm and it sticks, is that the vaccine? No, it's not. Shankar Kura is next on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Rumors and internet misinformation still abound about COVID and the COVID vaccine. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he's joining us now with an update. Dr. Kura, welcome back.
Lori, always a pleasure.
All right, here's the latest myth, and I think it's actually kind of a fun one because it's just, you know, tailor-made for the internet, and that is people taking refrigerator magnets and sticking them to their arm where they got the vaccination, and through a trick of surface tension or whatever, it sticks, and they say that is proof there is something in this vaccine that shouldn't be there. Not true. Tell us a little bit of what you're seeing that is driving some of those quirky myths and online shares.
Absolutely, Lori. It's kind of a, I was chuckling, smiling, whatever, when you started the whole conversation about magnets sticking to you and therefore in the vaccine. You know, we know what the components of the vaccine are, all three vaccines, the two mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna, and the one adenovirus vector vaccine, which is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. None of them have any magnetic metals or materials in them. It's pretty simple what the components are, some fats, sugars, and just a, you know, the mRNA, it's a synthetic protein made to resemble RNA. And in the case of the adenovirus vaccine of Johnson & Johnson, it's an engineered virus that cannot replicate. It just is carrying the the coded information to make the protein. So the real truth, it's even laughable that we have to continue to put away these myths about chips and magnets, and all those are not true. In fact, the amount of the vaccine is 1 milliliter. It's a really, really tiny, tiny, we're talking about a microscope level, and it's really a very safe, very effective vaccine. If you get the vaccine, the best thing you can do for yourself, you're protecting yourself against a disease that can ravage your organs and cause some long-term damage and, in some serious cases, deaths as well. So this vaccine is your shot to make sure you are have a good, happy, healthy life, and that you will continue to enjoy all the good things that you're blessed with.
Yeah, it does seem as we look around that the world here in South Dakota is returning to a sense of joyfulness and exuberance and normalcy, or the next normal, at least. How are we doing on distributing those vaccines? Because there's still work to be done, but we've already come so far. Give us a snapshot of where we're at today in the vaccination effort. Yeah.
Yes, Lori. Unfortunately, we did very well with the older age group. So we're at 90% of 65 and older folks in the state of South Dakota have at least received one dose. Unfortunately, it's not the same case from the ages 18 through 54. That group is at 50%. And then the new group, 12 to 18, as you would expect, they're just start 12 to 16, 17, they're just started. So they're about 10% for the state. That puts us at 25th if you rank this in all 50 states. So we're right in the middle. We're kind of an average state right now, even though we started strong. So like you correctly said, we have a long way to go. The important thing for these younger folks all the way from 12 through 54 is to go get the shot.
Yeah. You are the influencers next, because it's all about those relationships with physicians, but also when we look at a fun internet ice bucket challenge, I don't know, get your shot and dump a bucket of ice over your head. Think of something, Gen Z, and encourage encourage each other to go get that shot. I want to take a darker turn now, because as happy as we are about the progress here at home, there are devastating stories throughout the world, particularly in India right now. What are your thoughts as you watch what's happening in India, for what it means not only for the people there, people you may know, but also for the rest of us as variants are given the chance to take hold when the virus is so uncontrolled?
Yeah, very tragic what's going on across the world. This is a global problem. All pandemics are, and this pandemic is no different. Until and unless we can get vaccines to the world, we're not going to be, out of the woods. The good news, the bright spot for the United States, is we have been very fortunate to get at least our 65 and older in the 90% range across the country. And if we can just make that additional effort and get the rest of the younger age groups also vaccinated, we'll be in good shape. What is worrisome, however, is the fact that countries such as India, for whatever reasons, now they're so far behind, and this surge of cases that we're not even sure what the extent of the problem is because of the lack of, testing and supplies and so on and so forth, really is challenging. Because once you get so far behind in a vast country that's mostly poor, 80 to 90% of the country is really living in poverty, it is no longer even a challenge. You just can't meet logistically, get the vaccines, even if you were to say all of a sudden find all the vaccines to get to that nation. So that's really the challenge the world faces.
So much more to talk about as this pandemic continues, and we'll continue talking with you, Dr. Shankar Kura. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Lori.
Dr. Kerr is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. We'll put links up for where you can get your vaccine on our website at sdpb.org. Coming up next on the program, Coming Home, we talk about a public media collaboration and what we know now that we didn't know before about how we see ourselves. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Coming Home is a public media collaboration. It seeks to tell the stories of rural America. These are our stories, and we have more stories to tell. Stories to tell each other, stories to tell the world. Well, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is one of 10 stations nationwide to be selected by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for participation in the Coming Home Project. You're going to hear much more about it in the days ahead, but today we're going to look at the project with Dr. Shane Nordyke. She leads the Cheeseman Center for Democracy at the University of South Dakota, and she's joining us now from the SDPB studios in Vermilion. Dr. Nordyke, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
So for people who don't know what the Cheeseman Center for Democracy is, before we talk about Coming Home, let's talk about the Cheeseman Center. How do you explain it to people?
Yeah, so the Cheeseman Center for Democracy is an organization designed to support research and civic engagement activities that help to address just the ongoing challenges we have in American democracy. We try to develop programs that help to facilitate public dialogue, that increase active civic engagement, people becoming more involved in their communities, and promote civic values. So we do that by supporting things like Kids Vote, that we help to support for all of our K-12 school systems that want to participate. We support a variety of different research projects related to problems and issues of democracy or civic engagement. And then recently we've created some grants that both nonprofit organizations and also educators throughout the state can apply for to help support similar activities that help to promote democracy or civic engagement.
Yeah. A great synergy between South Dakota Public Broadcasting and public media in general with some of the things that you were talking about there just really resonate. There's a lot of information about Coming Home online. We're going to put some links up on our website, but I want you to tell me the story of Coming Home as we look at some of the survey that we're going to talk about here shortly. So how do you explain Coming Home to people?
Yeah, so when we originally talked about this collaboration, the idea behind the Coming Home grant was really how can we tell stories from rural America and have them being told by rural Americans themselves? There was this sense that often the story of what it's like to be in rural America is told through the lens of or by people who are not in rural America, who are on the coast or who are in D.C., and they often miss you know, the necessary context and nuance for understanding those stories. And so we wanted to be able to reach out to people themselves and get a view of how do they see themselves and how do they see themselves reflected through the media that they consume and what's important to them, what's important to them about their communities and what do they want to hear, how do they want to see their communities reflected in the stories that are told about them.
Yeah, one of our favorite, I don't know if it was a joke or a thing of note, every time we read one of these national stories as reporters kind of parachuted into South Dakota was, you know, they like to describe the wind. See, here's another story where somebody led with how windy it is in the moment they arrived. And it's such a stark thing because, yes, if you live here, you see yourself as so much more than, you know, a cold day, for example. Explain the survey methodology and broadly speaking, what kinds of questions did the survey ask?
Yeah, and I can kind of back up a little bit too to say, you know, the survey is one of a three-pronged approach that we took. So, you know, we wanted to do kind of an assessment of, you know, what can we know about South Dakota based on publicly available data that we already had? And then we designed the survey to help dig in deeper and to find out some more information about, and we asked a whole variety of questions. Some of those questions were questions that the Cheeseman Center was really excited about in terms of how people engage with their community and how they think about their political efficacy, how they consume news and information and how worried they are about fake news or misinformation that they find. And then a lot of the questions we asked were related to, stories about their community. What are the stories in your community that you most want to be told? We also asked questions about economic conditions and how COVID may have affected their individual finances or the businesses in their community. We asked some questions about healthcare, access to healthcare, the type of facilities that they might have available in their communities. One of the things we were really intentional about in creating the survey too was making sure that we had a sample that was really representative of the whole state. And so when we sent out invitations, we chose communities strategically to make sure that we had every region of the state represented, that we had towns of all different sizes, so very small towns and mid-sized towns and larger towns represented. And that we were really kind of targeting like that broad swath of South Dakotans so that we had not just those in Sioux Falls or those in Rapid City represented, but really, you know, South Dakotans from all over the state represented in the survey.
Yeah, and to note for our listeners, this is not a survey of members of SDPB. In fact, I think 75% of the respondents were non-members of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. So this is not a cross-section of our membership. This is a cross-section of the state of South Dakota.
Yeah, and that was really important to us. It was important to get beyond those who are already listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting and to represent the entire state.
Yeah, how comprehensive is this, the data right now compared to what else people, researchers might see coming from a place like South Dakota, which is often considered to be something of a data desert?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's data desert is a really good name for it in that, you know, when you look at national polls, South Dakota is often underrepresented because we're just not that large of a state comparatively. And, you know, I think people outside the state make a lot of assumptions about us being a monolith. We're mostly white. Hmm. We're mostly conservative. We mostly care about agriculture, you know, and so they just assume that they understand South Dakota without necessarily taking the time to collect this. So I do think that this is part of, I think we're seeing a recent trend. We're starting to see more good polling come out of South Dakota, and we're starting to see more representation of South Dakota voices. And I think it's giving us a lot to talk about because now for the first time, we're able to kind of see what our neighbors are saying and what it is that they care about. And it's going to be the start, I hope, of a lot of really good, meaningful conversations.
Let's talk about how people see, how do we see our communities? What are those things that are important to us? Where do you want to begin with some of that reflective knowledge that you've gleaned?
Yeah, I learned a ton from doing this. And so I'll just, you know, maybe highlight some of the things that were a surprise to me. And so some of these things are surprising, some of them aren't. The less surprising is that, you know, when you ask people the best thing about their communities, they're most likely to talk about people. People are really proud of their neighbors and their friends. They're proud of the resiliency in their communities. And because we asked this, you know, the survey was deployed last fall, so we were still dealing with COVID. We still are dealing with COVID. You heard a lot of people say, like, I want you to talk about this group of people who are overcoming these challenges and, you know, the good things that they're providing for their neighbors or how they've been able to continue to do these things. So that wasn't surprising. I've lived in Vermilion since 2008. And certainly if someone were to ask me what the best part of my community is, I would say the people in my community and all the good things that they are doing. I think the more surprising parts, though, when you dig in a little bit deeper, we found that, you know, what it's like to live in South Dakota really varies depending on who you are. So which community that you live in, what you look like, what your income is, all of those things end up having an impact on how you experience living in South Dakota and the access to resources that you have or the concerns you have about what's happening in the state or why you might leave the state. Those really vary based upon who you are and where you live.
Wow. One of the things I thought was fascinating is the question, you know, what are the reasons you might leave a community? Why would you leave South Dakota? What did you learn when you asked that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting question. And one of the reasons that we asked that question was not to prompt people to leave, but, you know, we often talk about brain drain, or we often talk about, you know, are young people leaving the state and what are some of the reasons that they might. You know, some of the reasons that were given were the things you would think of. So employment and opportunities was certainly one of the top five responses, and that makes sense, that if my job moved, then I would probably move, or if I could no longer find work here, I would move. But interestingly, the most cited reason for leaving South Dakota across the broad sample was actually politics. And this really kind of ran the gamut. We had people who were worried about South Dakota becoming too progressive of a state, and so they would leave if it continued to become more progressive. And then we had other people saying, I'm going to leave because I don't feel like I'm represented. It's too conservative of a state, or it's not accepting or welcoming enough, and I feel like I don't have a voice. And so we really saw across the ideological spectrum, South Dakotans worried about the nature of politics in the state and that being something that might cause them to leave. We also saw that when you broke down the comments, so we went in and we sorted the comments in a variety of different ways. We sorted them by age bracket, we sorted them by, you know, race, we sorted them by region, and we found some interesting patterns. So when you ask white respondents about reasons that they might leave the state, many of them say, you know, many of them sort of jokingly said, well, death, because that would be the only reason that they might leave, rather than they're not leaving.
Sure.
But they talked about, they talked about better career opportunities. They talked about politics. They talked about the weather occasionally. And then some of them did mention things like crime. But when you looked at the responses from Native American respondents, they talked about violence in their communities. They talk about a lack of safety for their children due to alcohol or drugs in their communities. They talked about a sense of homelessness. And then they also just talked about some of the people and how they were treated within their communities. And so we saw really different reasons that might push those people out of this state than we did from the larger group of white respondents.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest leads the Cheeseman Center for Democracy. Your name is Dr. Shane Nordyke. And we're talking about this collaboration, this public media collaboration called Coming Home. You're going to hear a lot more about it in the days ahead. But Dr. Nordyke, you also mentioned something about access to health care. You asked about Medicaid and Medicare expansion. And it seems to me that if people weren't aware of what kind of health care services they had in their community 2 years ago, just about everybody was looking into it recently. Tell me a little bit about what you learned so far about how people think about their health care and their access to it, and then also how they think about this idea of expanding Medicaid.
Yeah, so there's really kind of three interesting findings here. One is that in general, respondents were very positive about their access to good quality health care in the state. And that was true, you know, pretty well across regions, that most people agreed that, you know, they had good quality health care. Interestingly, when you broke that down again, though, by looking at different types of respondents, if you asked white respondents their level of agreement with, I have access to good quality medical care, only 13% of those respondents disagreed with those statements when we add up those who strongly disagreed or somewhat disagreed. When you look at Native American respondents, 42% of them disagreed with that statement. So we saw really large disparities in terms of both access to good quality medical care and also the ability to afford good quality medical care. Even more interesting to me, though, was that despite sort of overall people feeling like they had access to good medical care, the support for expanding access to Medicaid was really strong. So over 50% of the respondents strongly agreed, or they said definitely yes, South Dakota should expand Medicare and Medicaid access in the state, with another 20% saying that they agreed. So in total, nearly three quarters of the respondents said that they agreed that we should be expanding Medicare and Medicaid access in the state.
Fascinating. Governor Dennis Dugard used to talk about how most people wanted it, but yet there wasn't the political appetite to make it happen. And that seems like that has not changed over time. We're still maybe in the same spot. Tell me a little bit about something else that you were surprised by or found interesting. I'm kind of curious about young people or immigrant populations. What from the information jumps out at you that you think, yeah, this is of note?
Yeah, Definitely. So one of the other things that we did, so in addition to this survey, we also did focus groups with some target populations that we wanted to talk to all across the state. So we talked to some young entrepreneurs in Lemon, South Dakota. We talked to some retired folks in Alcester. But probably the most memorable ones for me were we were talking to a group of Karen refugees who were in high school or recently had graduated from high school in Huron. I personally did not know anything about the Karen population prior to having this conversation with them. And so just getting to talk to them about what it was like to now grow up in Huron, South Dakota, and how they felt about their community, I think I went in having some assumptions about what it might be like to be a minority refugee in a predominantly white sort of rural area. And I was completely blown away by how wrong I was. They love living in Huron. They feel very comfortable. They feel very safe. Their parents, they kept talking about, like, our parents get to garden just like they got to garden at home. And the skies are so blue and the people are so welcoming. You could just tell how happy they were to be there. And their biggest concerns were that they weren't going to be able to stay there because they didn't necessarily want to have the same jobs that their parents had. So they felt like they were probably going to have to go to Sioux Falls or maybe even Minneapolis to be able to pursue the career path they wanted to. But they really wanted an opportunity to be able to stay close to their families and in a more rural part of the country. And so that was enlightening for me. And just to get to know them and what their experiences were like was really interesting.
Yeah, there is one moment more that I want to ask you about, and that is sitting around the table with your own family. And I think people listening right now could learn something from this idea of gathering people in your life to say, what do you like about your town? What do you value about this? What would make you want to leave, and what makes you want to stay or come home once again? Tell us a little bit about the personal side of this and just listening to kids and elders all in the same room saying, this is what home means to me. This is why I'm here.
Yeah, so this was an idea that we had. We were kind of basing it off of something that we had seen nationally where the, you know, Will Smith and his family, they have these red table talks, and we thought, right, well, this would be really interesting to replicate in a rural perspective. And so I'm really fortunate that, you know, I have two kids that live at home with me, one who is 10 and one who is 15. And then my mother and my grandmother both live next door to me. And since we've done this, my aunt actually moved in around the corner. So we have all these generations, and none of us, well, except for my son, who's 10, were born in South Dakota. We all have come to South Dakota later. And so our experiences have been very different, though my children have grown up here in Vermilion. And so we experience this town differently. My grandma, who came here, you know, in her 80s, experiences the town and the state very differently than I do. And we also have differences in how we think about what we want for the future of South Dakota, what would cause us to move away and what it is that we worry about. And I think, you know, what we wanted to do through that sort of simulation or that project was to just encourage families to sit down and have these conversations, to really try to relate to one another about, like, what is your experience really like? We tend to take for granted that the rest of our family is having the same experience that we are. But again, based on who we are and how we're sort of encountering that experience, they can be really different. So it was fun to sit and have that conversation, to, you know, hear what my grandma thinks, to, you know, have my mom talk about what it was like for her to move here after she retired. And so I hope more people start to have those conversations around the kitchen table about what's most important to them and what it is that they value about their communities.
Yeah, you're going to hear so much more about the Coming Home Project from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and South Dakota Public Broadcasting, the Cheeseman Center for Democracy. Dr. Shane Nordick has been with us. Shane, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a moment now and talk about one of our most beloved natural resources, our rivers. On this day 30 years ago, Congress approved the Niobrara Scenic River Act, establishing 39 miles of the Missouri River from Fort Randall to Running Water as part of the Wild and Scenic River System. The Wild and Scenic Rivers Act was signed into law by President Johnson in October of 1968. It classifies rivers as wild, scenic, or recreational, and it was intended to protect outstandingly remarkable values of America's wild places. Here's how it breaks down. Wild river areas are generally inaccessible except by trail. They're marked by watersheds or shorelines that are essentially primitive. Those scenic river areas are sections of rivers with shorelines or watersheds, still largely primitive. And then there are those recreational river areas. You know those. They're sections of rivers that are readily accessible. They might even have some development along their shorelines. The overall Wild and Scenic Act strives to balance dams and other construction at appropriate sections of rivers with permanent protection for some of the country's most outstanding and powerful free-flowing waterways. Niobrara National Scenic River, it's called, with its undisturbed shorelines, fossil sites, and rock formations and waterfalls. It was added to the national designation and includes parts of the river in Nebraska west to near Valentine, as well as the section of the Missouri River from upstream from Springfield, South Dakota. Well, when President Bush signed the Scenic River Designation Act of 1991 for the river, he had this to say: these rivers are an outstanding resource, and this bill will preserve and protect them for future generations as a worthy addition to the National Wild and Scenic River System. But he also paused to admonish Congress for passing the act without completing the formal study to be sure the designation would not infringe on the rights of private landowners along the rivers. That's this day in 1991 when Congress approved the Niobrara Scenic River Act. We'll be back with more Images of the Past on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting In the Moment, and I'm your host, Lori Walsh. A continental divide between Lake Traverse and Big Stone Lake in northeastern South Dakota marks the boundary between two massive watersheds. Rivers north of the boundary flow toward the Hudson Bay. Those to the south of the divide drain into the Mississippi River. Well, a plan dreamed up at the turn of the 20th century would have crossed that divide with a canal, which in turn might have made South Dakota a destination for international shipping. SDPB's Heather Benson is with us today for a segment of Images of the Past and Oh, What Might Have Been. Hey, Heather.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing well. Tell me the story of how this all kind of got started.
Well, I stumbled across the story in doing some research on another story about their state house, and in flipping through old newspapers, which if you've never been online, just a wonderful, you know, deep dive that you can never get out of. I came across this headline that I did not expect to see that said South Dakota to Liverpool, Big Stone Lake to be the terminus of a great canal. Mm-hmm. And what had happened is in 1896 and 97, it was one of the most heavy snow winters for the Northern Plains. And the Red River Valley up in North Dakota, which if you've ever been up there, is very flat. And because it's on the north side of that continental divide, it melts backwards is the best way to put it. The southern part starts melting first, and it takes a while to get those waters north. So Fargo flooded to a pretty extreme degree, which jump-started this conversation of how do we fix that? The Red River Valley was a hugely important agricultural area, and so it started with a really simple discussion. Can we cross that continental divide in South Dakota and try to drain the Red River south to the Mississippi River? And this, if you think about the time that this happened, this was, you know, the Suez Canal had got done in 1869. The conversations about the Panama Canal were in full swing. So America in particular had no problems talking big picture when it came to moving water around.
Right.
And
you just know, Heather, somebody looked at a map somewhere and said, you know, we're not on that map. What can we do?
Exactly.
Sort of like the Amtrak map or the Tesla charging station map. Somebody said, canal, let's bring it here. I love that.
So these guys in January of 1900, they met in this little teeny tiny town in White Rock, South Dakota to meet with what was called the Tri-State Drainage Canal Association. And like I said, originally it was just going to be this little canal between the two lakes. And You know, I think we've all been in those brainstorming sessions where someone comes up with a really crazy idea and, you know, there's not enough people in the room to go, wait a minute. And they started running with this idea of, well, why can't we just extend the canal all the way up the Red River, all the way to Lake Minnetonka, and then across northern Manitoba to Hudson Bay. So if anyone grabs a map and looks, we're talking about an extraordinary distance through some straight up wilderness when you get into Manitoba. But what it would have done is make us a terminal port like Chicago or Duluth for that North Atlantic shipping lane, which if you think about that, would have really changed the look and, you know, the operation of northeastern South Dakota.
Yeah. How much would it have cost?
Well, that's the crazy thing. So in 1900, their estimated cost was about $1 million, which is about $31 million in today's dollars.
Creating new music can be emotional release, artistic expression, and mathematical challenge. Now, a new South Dakota publication looks to highlight local musicians. We'll talk with the creator of the zine Tiger Meat tomorrow. But first, let's listen to one of the artists featured in the inaugural issue of Tiger Meat. Here is Katie Dwyer talking with us for Moment in Sound when she joined us in February.
Yeah, I feel like my whole life has been a journey to this point. I started out songwriting when I was still a kid, and at that time I was kind of what I call like a closet songwriter. Didn't really show anyone, except for maybe really close friends or family members that I really thought that I was like confident would appreciate it. I wouldn't show anyone unless I knew they were like already going to enjoy it pretty much. And it wasn't till the end of high school that I finally wrote some songs that I decided these are good enough that I could play them at a coffee shop or an open mic or something. And I lived in Southern California at the time, so there was a lot of those that were welcoming. And I decided to start performing just around my own town and at small venues, and I got really good feedback. So I think that from there, it kind of just grew into something that was, the writing process was such a nice release, and then performing those songs was also just something that I really loved to do. But I definitely was still a hobbyist, and I think that the main reason I didn't ever consider going for it is because it was kind of put in my head that this is a hobby, you know, and it didn't really seem like an option to take it seriously and try to do it as a career. So I didn't. And I think, yeah, finally, like, it wasn't until I was pregnant with my daughter and I quit my job and I decided that summer, because my daughter is my fourth child, so I have three boys and a girl, and I just decided, well, this summer, instead of putting my boys in childcare and working all summer and making not much more than it costs to put three children in childcare full time, right. I'm just gonna quit and do music, and I'll just try to make enough money, like more money than I would at my regular job. And if I do, then I know that I made a really great choice, because then I can spend all that time with my children and, make about the same amount anyway. And I met that goal really easily. And then when my daughter was born, I was like, well, geez, I need to figure out something, because I want to continue doing this, but I don't want to leave my daughter because she was so little. And so I started looking into online ways to be a musician.
Yeah, I want to pause here and introduce listeners to Katie Dwyer by playing this song. It's called Making Me Choose, and it is from her new EP called Indiscreet. Take a listen.
It's scary going after your dreams, feeling failure, catching not to do what I need.
'cause I'm pretty sure this is what crazy people do.
You're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting for today's Moment in Sound. Katie Dwyer is with us. Her new EP is called Indiscreet, and that song was called Making Me Choose. And Katie, we've been talking about which one is our favorite from the album, and people have different opinions about that because I like the whole album, and it is hard to choose, but I'm picking Sleep as my favorite. Just very briefly, so listeners can hear some of this, tell us about this song, Sleep.
So I have to say, I think that one is my favorite too. So we must have similar tastes. Yeah, it's very hard to choose. They're very, different from each other, I guess. I mean, they all have my sound, you could say, but I do think that they're pretty different from each other as far as, how they sound, and the instrumentation all varies slightly. Sleep is the only one with no drums in it, and it's a song that I wrote. Well, I wrote the words on the way from Pierre to a tiny town in Wyoming near Cody. It's called Meteetse, Wyoming, and that's where my grandmother and my great grandmother lived. And my great grandma was dying, and I just had to make peace with the fact that I might not get there in time to say goodbye. And these words came to me, and I felt like it helped me, because it kind of puts this in perspective. Like, it's not really about me. It's not really about anyone else. And I don't get to tell somebody, you know, oh, wait until I get to say goodbye to you before you leave, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's where the words originally stemmed from. And it's kind of the same as the last song. If you just listen to it, you're not going to like put all that together. You definitely don't hear the whole story behind where the song came from, but that's where it originally came from.
Yeah. Here is just a little bit of Katie Dwyer's Sleep.
I don't want to make you wait. If you need to take your place somewhere far, far away.
Music there from Katie Dwyer. She joined us for Moment in Sound in February. On tomorrow's In the Moment, we talk with John Bakken. He's the creator of the zine called Tiger Meat. It is designed to help amplify the voices of South Dakota musicians. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about nurses and trauma. What happened to healthcare providers as they tended to so many sick and dying South Dakotans, and how does their experience and the impact of it resonate with people who treat combat veterans? For Steve Zwemke, Josh Heyer, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.